This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, June 21st, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/VeraIcona100. Welcome to the program, Veronica.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
Doing very well.
Good. I just finished reading your article about these, let's see, what is the name? The Nazi medical experiment hoax. And I'm so glad that you wrote this article.
Really? I am too. It just a sudden inspiration. After hearing that last program,
yeah.
This is one of those lies that persists. And if people just go to the VeraIconaPublishers.org and look at that picture at the top, that is supposed to be Dr. Rauscher. Now, on the right. Now, if one looks at this picture, one cannot actually make out his face clearly. I question whether it's really even him. How do we know? Can anyone positively identify with his face looking down like that? It's a strange picture.
Right.
So, you know, that's just one of those things. And this photo is one of the number one things put out there as evidence of, you know, Germans killing people with either freezing or high altitude or whatever the case is.
Right. Yes. It's a very, very good article. And, after reading through it, I mean, how can people believe this stuff?
I don't know. I mean, the metal hammer coming down on the 11-year-old's head repeatedly. Who would do that, first of all? Especially to a child. And I'm sorry, but the little one would have died. You can't repeatedly bring some iron thing down on someone's head and think they're just going to be insane afterward. In fact, that doesn't even make sense. You'd be so severely brain damaged or dead that you wouldn't even use the term insane. It's
right.
That's just silly. So, yeah, there's lots of that.
Right. And you indicate that there's a lot of records in the National Archives in Washington, mm-hmm. and unfortunately, they are in the German language. And so it's, you know, only people who can read German are actually going to look at those, or somebody that has interest and reads German. And you mentioned that Fritz Berg has done that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he's the only one that has, at least that I've talked to.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can get all the IMT garbage in English, but if you want the actual German data, you know, various communications reports about what was done, you see the truth. And they do not reference the death of even one person in the high altitude experiments that were conducted, only that prisoners lost consciousness and that they had volunteered to do this. They got sometimes extra food rations. Sometimes their sentences were commuted if they were a criminal. So they were volunteers. And of course, I put a recent article about a medical experiment gone terribly awry in Britain. It's, what's the name of the article? Recent human medical experiment in Britsy, England went awry. And this happened not too long ago. So these people are now going to have a lifetime risk of cancer and arthritis because of this antibody drug TGN-1412 that was tested on them in the UK. And one patient lost fingers and toes to gangrene because of this. And these two Dutch experts told these scientists before they did this experiment there were serious issues that had not yet been dealt with. And of course, the patients were not given any of this information. So if we want to talk about medical experiments, let's talk about the ones going on today in the United States and in Britain with human guinea pigs. That's exactly how they described these poor people.
Sure. I mean, just the fact that vaccines are known to cause so many illnesses, And they've been using these vaccines. Well, look at fluoride vaccines. What are some other things? Aspartame, and all of these things are dangerous.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they've been using them for years and years, decades.
Right. I mean, there's no need to go to any fictitious, quote unquote, Nazi medical experiments, anyone. We can go to any kind of researchers today. There's a lot of crazy cancer research going on even today that's extremely risky and insane, such as taking all of someone's blood out, nearly all of it, refrigerating it, treating it with chemotherapy, and putting it back into the patient. Some experimental cancer treatment, this kind of nonsense is what goes on today. There's no need to go to IMT fictitious accounts.
Right.
And I guess with that, we can go into the fictitious diary of Dr. Goebbels, his
Okay.
Tagebuch, because we're going to be talking about Kristallnacht. All right, I went through this Tagebuch thing. Now, this is the section of sections, actually, of Goebbels' diaries, allegedly, that only Moscow has. Only they were privy to this information. And they have it on what they call plate glass. I guess it's like microfiche or whatever. And they'll only have certain lines from different dates. Well, they magically have all the missing information from Kristallnacht, of all the things they could possibly have. Now, the Germans weren't even given access to this information until, I believe, 1992. So I've already found evidence that they've been doctored. They're either 100% fraudulent or partially fraudulent. The fact that they're partially fraudulent, they must be discarded completely.
Sure.
And of course, I still have to do the last chapter, but Kristallnacht 1938 by Alan E. Steinweiss. He pretty much undoes the entire thing on accident. So, he's a good one to go to just to see how idiotic the official historical line is on Kristallnacht, because it's just, he can't get around the insane anomalies, the stupid, chaotic way in which this was allegedly ordered. And of course, he does not even mention Ingrid Veckert, who our main focus is on today. So he's missing a tremendous amount of information. And of course, every single review on the back of the book is written by a fellow Jewish historian. So he's fully endorsed by, the cabal, if you will.
Certainly.
But he has heavy reliance on this Goebbels diary. So let's just go through some of these things.
Okay.
First of all, on November 9th, Goebbels allegedly writes on Mittwoch, which is Wednesday, about anti-Jewish actions in Hesse and condones it, thinks it's great. Oh, the people are finally talking. Their wrath has been unleashed, including the burning of synagogues. He's thrilled about this. I'm thinking, I don't think so. Dr. Goebbels, manager of perception extraordinaire, we must remember this is right after the Vienna arbitration, the Munich agreement, and all of a sudden Hitler and Goebbels are having a pogrom that does incredible damage to their international reputation.
Right.
That's insane. The United States recalled their ambassador, I believe it was. And I think it was their ambassador. I'll have to double check that. But they recalled this official. And of course, Germany in turn recalled theirs. I'm almost certain it's the ambassador. That's a big deal. That wasn't going over too well in Germany. So this had severe international repercussions.
Of
And of
course.
course, oh yeah, and the British and American press were screaming, and even Goebbels was like, they are totally exaggerating. This is crazy. They need to be reprimanded. So he couldn't have done worse damage to himself. it doesn't make sense that Goebbels ordered this.
Right.
And of course, he's trying to attribute this in this diary entry to the Vom Rath murder. Now, there were some spontaneous demonstrations and actions, with regards to this murder.
Germans, as there would be.
Yeah, Germans and many Austrians were outraged. So this is the thing that everyone leaves out. On the 7th and the 8th, before the quote-unquote pogrom was quote-unquote ordered by the NSDAP, which Steinbeis pins on Hitler directly, there were already riotous actions going on. Gee, why did the people precede the pogrom order? That's ridiculous.
Right.
So, of course, Goebbels and Hitler, if they made any comments that kind of said, well, you know, what did the Jews expect? You know, there's some stuff here and there. Of course, they cracked down on it, but it doesn't mean that they're behind it, even if they make a casual remark about it. Goebbels tended to be extremely sarcastic, especially when it came to Jews. And he might occasionally go, oh, yeah, they kind of deserve it. That doesn't mean he ordered the pogrom. So, you know, people need to be careful getting too serious about statements. Statements are not facts. They are merely words in the wind. If there is no order or corroborating forensic or factual evidence to go with the statement, a statement is just words. It isn't anything more than that. So, you know, that's the problem with a lot of eyewitness stuff. And of course, Steinbeis relies on that extensively, the statements allegedly made. Of course, Goebbels doesn't give us a time when he supposedly wrote this. So we have no idea what time any of this was occurring. That seems a little convenient. So this is what Weckert says. She does not specify when exactly the synagogues in Hesse were attacked or whether they were burned. Now, Goebbels supposedly says they're burning and gives no time. What we do know for sure from her is that Goebbels warned all those present. Some of these people were NSDAP members. Others were SA and SS. And many of them had already taken leave when Hitler did around 1 a.m. on November 10th. So Goebbels wasn't even talking to everyone. It was only those who remained past 1 at the celebration of the pooch. So this was kind of for the old guard to celebrate, like, the original NS members who had sacrificed their lives for the movement, etc. They had this whole big deal they were doing in Munich. Okay. So he gives a speech. Now, why would he order a pogrom when not everyone's present? They had already left.
Yes.
That's idiotic. So what he does tell them, the people that are still present, after a little bit of news comes in about some of the stuff going on, burning of synagogues, some actions being taken, Goebbels didn't know exactly what was going on and how much. He said, quote, "Do not take part in any of these actions," end quote. That was his specific order. So this idea that Goebbels' speech that night was, and this comes from people who heard it. Problem is, we do not actually have the text of that speech, but this is reliable witnesses who are not, you know, totally idiotic. One just needs to read Baldur von Schirach's and others' accounts of his speech. What they're saying, it was dripping with anti-Jewish venom, and you're just going, no, 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 no. You said that for the IMT. So, and of course, everyone rushes to the phones to tell their SA regiments, leaders, etc., do not participate. This is not sanctioned. It's not okay.
Right.
Okay, so that's what Goebbels did. Here's a little news about what's going on. Says don't take part. Okay. Goebbels really did think they were spontaneous riots instigated by Vom Rath's death, though a riot before Vom Rath actually died is perhaps a little odd, because he hadn't died yet. He passed away at 5:30 p.m. on November 9th. So the riots had actually started before this on the 9th.
So it must have been, maybe it was somebody that that knew that somebody had assaulted him with the intention of killing him,
right.
And they just jumped the gun. And who would know about an intended assassination but somebody that perhaps knew about the intentions?
Right. That's a possibility. It seemed a little strange to me that all these actions were starting to pick up and accelerate before the man even passed away.
Yes.
Because, you know, Germans weren't yet sure whether he was going to die. They weren't privy to that information. Hitler was. His personal doctor was there attending to him. I mean, the German people were kept abreast of, you know, he was given this treatment, he's still alive, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they didn't know for sure he was going to die. So it does seem a little too soon, in my opinion, because they really started accelerating around early evening, these events, and mm-hmm. then took off big time at night. And then, you know, as I already said, there were some anti-Jewish demonstrations already on the 7th and 8th.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, those could not have possibly been ordered by Hitler or Goebbels on the 10th.
Right.
So, you know, it's just that kind of idiocy.
Well, Jews have a reputation and a history of starting these kinds of movements, starting this agitation against themselves, basically, and pretending that it's somebody else. It's, you know, the old false flag kind of a thing, tactic. And they've been doing it for a long time. And they did it a lot in Europe, in Russia, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it's important to note that a pogrom had not occurred in Western Europe since the Middle Ages in Germany.
Uh-huh.
All of a sudden, the NSDAP orders a pogrom. It just is, it's nonsensical. It really is. And even Steinweiss has to admit, it was so chaotic and so disorganized. Gee, those are two things that just don't go hand in hand with Hitler.
No,
not at all. So very orderly, very prudish, anal retentive.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be having chaotic. And he even goes, it's embarrassing because Heinrich Müller, allegedly put out this telex. The orders are so vague and so bizarrely worded as to be hysterical. He didn't have the authority to even order what he did. He was not yet head of the Gestapo at the time. So whoops, the IMT blew it on that one. They didn't really understand Heinrich Müller's position in 1938. So that's boo-boo number one on his telex that went out. Well, his language is completely idiotic, completely vague. It was so vague and so confusing, Steinweiss says, that no one knew quite how to interpret it. And they're like, well, how do we go about determining which Jews to arrest? Where should we send them? Do we burn synagogues? Do we just bash in the windows? What do they mean by extreme measures? No one knew because it was so absurdly worded, obviously because it was written by the Allies.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is Heydrich went, oh, this can't work. I got to be more specific. So he puts out another telex. By the time this telex gets out, it's like the next day. I don't think so. You know, it's just this kind of idiocy that he has to correct Müller's telex because it's so stupid.
Yes.
And even Heydrich's telex, which is another fraud, extremely vague, bizarrely written. It's just not proper German.
Right.
So there's many other things about that we'll get to, but that's really what they're relying on, is those telexes are so important to the case. And as soon as you undermine that, it collapses. Another thing about this Goebbels diary thing, he mentions on the 10th that SA chief Lutze, who is very prominent in Weckert's book, bitterly complains about the SS. Yet, the SA and the SS were supposedly working together closely and in conjunction to orchestrate the Kristallnacht action.
Hmm.
That very night. He had kind of a rivalry going with Himmler and resented him and was envious. A little strange there.
Yes.
And Weckert mentions that the SA was not subordinate to the SS, and in fact, they were rivals. So this is a bit odd, you know, that they're working in conjunction. And the official story tells us that the SS ordered the SA around.
Oh, okay.
That's not possible. So this is, again, a person who wrote it that doesn't understand the command structure of the NSDAP.
Right.
And then right after Goebbels' speech, Lütze telephoned all SA leaders, who then informed their subordinates not to participate and to prevent further looting and property damage. So, no, he didn't rush to the phone and everyone rushed to the phone and go, kill Jews or destroy synagogues. No, they were saying, do not participate and prevent whatever you can.
Right. I mean, the whole world was looking at Germany. This is the worst thing that they could have done. But you have to look at who benefits in
sure.
everything. And the Jews were the only people that really benefited. Certainly, there was some destruction. How many people died?
The total death, I believe, it's either 36 or 92 or 91, but there's two figures given, so we don't know for sure. Heydrich issued two different death counts. Everyone runs with 91. I think that was actually officially acknowledged. And that could have been, it could have been 36 who were actually murdered and then 91 died in total simply because of like maybe a heart attack after the fact, you know, elderly people, stuff like that. There were very few extremely violent incidents. There were a couple, but those were prosecuted by the NS High Court. The National Socialists themselves prosecuted those most violent crimes, and Heydrich was... He's all rape, the instances of rape and anything like that need to be very harshly dealt with.
Right.
So that was maximum sentence. And of course, those people were booted out of the party in the SA.
Right. And they would, if it had been something that they had ordered, they wouldn't have prosecuted the people for doing that because it was, after all, under orders. So... Obviously,
right.
This whole thing falls apart because of the actions that they took after it, and because they said, you know, do not participate.
Right. Only some of the perpetrators were pardoned later by Hitler, and those were the ones who were less. They really. Heydrich said, really focus on the motive. It's very important that I see what the motive is, because in some instances we're going to be more lenient. Like if it was somebody, there was one man who was literally badgered on by his SA comrades, very much against his will, who ended up shooting this Jewish woman. And I mean, he was totally distraught over it. So, but he was ordered to do it repeatedly and badgered. So this was a case of extreme bullying by his fellow SA men. And that kind of a case was pardoned. Anything
right.
where it was just a, you know, your own initiative kind of murder, you know, the malicious type of stuff, that was prosecuted. So, yeah, we can't use the pardoning argument because Hitler didn't pardon very many people. It was
right.
only a few. So again, back to Goebbels on the 10th in his entry, this is now November 10th, he has three corrections that were made to his text. They're brackets. Not likely to have those brackets in your own diary.
Right.
Those were added by Moscow.
Oh, really?
Or perhaps the German typists. Somebody corrected his diary. So in this one sentence, it's nun aber ist es just G, the word G. Somebody added the AR with brackets, and that literally means, but now it is, we don't know what the last word was supposed to be, whether it was a cutoff sentence. They simply just put good as, you know, gar. Now, but now it is good. Implication? Is he implicating himself? Yes, he is. So... You know, you can't just add whatever you want to somebody's diary when you really don't know what that word was and it's cut off.
Right.
And then he's got another one. Der Führer hat angeordnet, dass zwei, he gives the number two, so this is the Führer then ordered, that between 2-30,000 Juden sofort zu verhaften sind, which means he's now ordered that between 2-30,000 Jews need to be, you know, taken into custody, arrested. Somebody added a 5 in brackets so that it was 25-30,000. That corresponds exactly with the two fraudulent telexes, which give the exact figure of 20-30,000 with a hyphen. I'm like, would he put that in his diary?
No.
The Führer now ordered 25-30,000 Jews arrested. That's idiotic.
Right.
That was added after the fact. I'm sure of it. I have no doubt about it. I really wish we could see those microfiche copies, because we would then see the original writing of Goebbels versus what was added. It's got to be slightly different.
Sure. And those are at the archives in Moscow?
Yes. The only thing the Germans have is the transcriptions typed up.
Hmm.
So when you order Goebbels' Tagebücher, it's just typed up.
Right.
You don't get to see his actual physical handwriting. I mean, some people have said these were even destroyed. So how does Moscow have them? Dug them up? There's weird stuff behind this whole thing.
Sure. And yeah. Moscow has been known to create illusions and all kinds of things. So I wouldn't trust them for anything.
Sure. Yeah. And then he's got another sentence. Basically, throughout the entire Reich, he's saying in German. 50 synagogen brennen. So how many synagogues are burning? He says 50, then 7. Moscow again corrected that, or the Germans or whoever put this bracket to 75 synagogues. We do not, you just can't do that. You know, and trust a document. So errors in his diary is a bit odd.
Right.
And of course, we have to ask, why are these things cut off? Huge questions around all these entries. Goebbels also refers to Hitler's Stosstrupp. This is very important because this term went out in 1923.
Oh.
The SS was brought into being in 1925. It completely replaced the Stosstrupp, which was Hitler's personal, like, old guard core SS, if you will, before they were actually officially the SS. So the SS is sanctioned in 25. Stosstrupp goes out in 23. Yet Goebbels uses that term like 4 different times alongside SS. So he uses SS and then goes to Stosstrupp. There's no way he would have said that, referred to them as such in 1938.
Oh,
we're talking
no.
about...
Yes.
You know, more than 10 years later.
Right.
That doesn't make sense. That seems like it was written by someone who wasn't quite privy to this name change.
Right.
And then, you know, as I said, he uses the term SS, so why use the two together in the same sentence even? And then here's another, this struck me as strange. Goebbels writes literally, "Bravo!" exclamation mark. "Bravo!" exclamation mark in his diary, in reference to the burning synagogues.
Amazing.
Who writes that kind of a thing in their diary? It that's idiotic.
Right. Now this diary, it was used at the trials.
I don't believe there are any references to his diaries. I don't think Moscow shared that at the time of the IMT. This came out only later, and now historians are of course using it to indict Goebbels for Kristallnacht.
Oh.
This is the only source that actually indicts him.
I see. So probably it wouldn't even be an issue if they hadn't lost the war.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so now they've got to go back and kind of build a case against Germany.
Sure. We have no idea when Moscow introduced these forgeries into this diary, but there's a couple that are real bloopers, so we'll get to those in just a sec. Again, these weren't turned over to the Germans to typescript to copy until 1992.
Wow, that's interesting. It's interesting that they wouldn't bring them up at the IMT, but it's when you look at all the other stuff that has come out to try and keep putting the guilt upon Germany and upon the Germans, it makes sense that they would keep something back to bring out later.
Yeah, I'm not. These may have been discovered later after the IMT, and so they didn't yet have this information, and it didn't fit with the image they needed, and so it was doctored. I'll have to check that again because I'm not totally sure when these were discovered. I'm sure I saw the date, but it's not sticking in my head right now. So then Goebbels goes on to say he went with Schaub to the Künstlerclub, the arts club at midnight. That's a little strange. Why are we going to an arts club at midnight? Schaub was with Hitler at 1 a.m. in Hitler's apartment, however. So he was with Goebbels just an hour before at the Künstlerclub and then jams over to Hitler's apartment at 1. Okay, so there's potential chronology, same time, same place issues there. I mean, how long did it take to get from the Künstlerclub to Hitler's apartment? Is it possible to even do that in an hour? These are things we need to start asking. Somebody who's familiar with Germany back then and the distance it would be, etc., type of travel you would have to take, would have to look into this. This isn't probably something I can verify. But yet, Goebbels commented that Schaub's old Stosstrupp sentiment was awakened that night when he's, kind of reminiscing in his supposed diary. Clearly, he didn't join his fellows, though, who Goebbels allegedly said, quote, went out and totaled Munich, end quote. So, okay, Schaub is, he's had his Stosstrupp evilness awaken in him. He wants to just go out there and, bash and trash those synagogues in Munich. So why did he go with Goebbels? That doesn't make sense. Okay, so then also on the 10th, this is pretty much the last part here. Goebbels remarks that the quote, entire nation, end quote, is uprising, which is total nonsense. First of all, he had no idea at that point in time how broad this was. No idea. No one did. Not even Hitler did. Only, and it turns out, only 1,000th of 1%, between 5 to 7,000 people participated in this so-called nationwide pogrom. That would be a really idiotic thing for Goebbels to write in his diary. And of course, Hitler didn't even know he was ordering this pogrom, which was totally chaotic and disorganized, as I mentioned, until after he wrote his NS Old Town Hall speech, the Bürgerbräukeller speech, given on the 10th. He didn't even mention von Rath's murder one time. So if he really wanted to stir people up, he could have gone on and on about that von Rath thing and stirred up the people. If anyone could have done it verbally, it was Hitler, not Goebbels.
Oh, absolutely.
And so what does Steinweiss say? Oh, well, this was plausible deniability. See, Hitler distanced himself. He didn't order anything, didn't write anything down, couldn't be heard by anyone, only whispered and gestured and winked and nodded. Didn't mention von Rath at all, and went to his apartment to pretend he was oblivious. Plausible deniability. That's insane. What he's saying is, I don't have any evidence to tie Hitler to this, so I'm just going to go ahead and say that Hitler distanced himself from it intentionally. You cannot do that. That's like a logical fallacy with a million red beeping lights around it. And, Steinweiss just carries on and says basically the entire NS system and regime was plausible deniability. It even goes to the Holocaust. See, that's why Hitler never had an order.
Right. It
This
was
is
all in code,
insane.
right?
It's insane. And so I'm like, okay, well, you know what, everyone, from now on, if revisionists don't have any evidence, plausible deniability. So now we're going to say that the Jews, you can't connect like a 100%, you know, you don't have that smoking gun, plausible deniability. So anyway, here's the most stunning entry of all that I've gotten to. I'm not totally done with this, but he wrote that he, quote, heard rattling window panes as he drove to the hotel. First of all, when you're driving in a car,
you don't hear anything like that.
No, you ain't going to hear rattling, crashing window panes. Totally idiotic. And then here's the problem. He allegedly drove to the hotel. What hotel? We're not told. But this is wrong. Goebbels drove to the main Munich railroad station and on to Berlin. He and Dr. Naumann were met at the station by Görlitzer. So we have two corroborating witnesses who in Görlitzer was the deputy Gauleiter of Berlin. They met him at the station. Goebbels was outraged. He was yelling at Görlitzer, "What is going on? You're the deputy Gauleiter. I was over in the Munich thing. You know, why is there stuff going on in Berlin?" He was shocked and very upset.
Right.
Okay. Well, in Berlin, he went from Berlin when he was there, he went straight to the propaganda ministry and issued a pronouncement to the people to desist from any further actions. So he did not go to a hotel. That is a flub.
Hmm.
He went straight to the Munich railroad station, met Görlitzer, and then in Berlin went straight to the propaganda ministry. No hotel. That's a huge mistake. So I say just forget the Goebbels diaries. Goebbels Tagebücher.
Right.
And again, those are the only ones Moscow has. None of the other diaries are implicating. That's just too suspicious to me.
The whole thing with Kristallnacht is very questionable to me. I really believe it was a self-inflicted wound that the Jews initiated because it was in conjunction with the murder, and the murder was committed by, who was the name of the kid that committed the murder?
Herschel Greenspan.
Greenspan. Right. So I just think it was a big... it was an operation that was centered on the murder, and they used that to create an action against themselves, because they are the only ones that benefited.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it brought the world's criticism against the Third Reich, and that benefited the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Right. And even Steinweiss admits that a significant percentage of German Jews had lived for a long time not in large cities, but rather in the more provincial places. Now, the thing is many of the towns that were, you know, part of this alleged pogrom were unknown even to experienced scholars of German history. This is something that the Zionists would have known only too well, being in constant contact with German Jews.
Right.
Which he references on page 38. And if you look at a map of Germany, you'll see, like, you can actually look up on the internet Kristallnacht, the nationwide pogrom, November 9th and 10th, a map of it, and they'll show you the concentration. It's almost, the vast, vast majority is Hesse, which is, like, the majority, like, rural. Now, that's strange to me. The rural concentration is strange to me. Why not in the cities? So let me see where this thing is. Well, here's a really, this is just stunning coming from Steinweiss. And this is why I say this kind of in the rural areas where the Jews would be most vulnerable and there'd be fewer police to protect them.
Right.
Zionists knew that.
Right.
He writes, "On November 8th, an envoy from the German Jewish community, Wilfried Israel, met with the British Charge d'Affaires in Berlin, Sir George, I think it's Ogilvy Forbes. Israel described the widespread, quote, apprehension that reprisals will be taken on Jews in Germany, end quote. Similarly, on November 9th, Chaim Weizmann, the president of the World Zionist Organization, telephoned Lord Halifax, the British foreign minister, expressing his fear based on reports from contacts in Germany that, quote, pogroms were about to start, end quote.
Hmm.
How did he know?
Yes, how did
Who
he know
phoned
indeed?
Him? Yeah.
Hmm.
Who phoned him? So, you know, there's some weird things there. Really
sure.
Weird things.
Definitely.
I'd say that's about it. But what's interesting is it wasn't until, and he has to admit it, it wasn't until after Kristallnacht occurred that gun control was enacted against Jews and gypsies.
Hmm.
1938, Jews still had guns and other weapons. So
really?
This
so,
idea that they couldn't defend themselves
yes.
during the Kristallnacht is a lie.
Yes, I was just going to ask, well, why didn't they defend themselves? Why
right.
is it that we always have these poor, defenseless victims, and they just can't help it? They just can't help it. They just march off to the death camps, and they can't protect themselves. And yet, they were known to be terrorists throughout Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
they were the terrorists. They were the ones that were assassinating political leaders. They were assassinating czars. And now, all of a sudden, in Germany, they are these victims who can't protect themselves?
Right.
I don't believe that.
Yeah. And I mean, just some of the idiotic things in the telex, for example. Heydrich is telling his subordinates to just arrest Jews who are propertied or affluent. How does one make that determination? That
Indeed.
Is just stupid. Could you show me your bank account, sir? Going door to door. Now, there were allegedly cases of extortion. I'm sure some of these are genuine. But at the Air Ministry, where Frick, Goering, et al. Met on the 12th, Frick said any cases, and this has come to my attention, this what happened as a result after Kristallnacht, partially as a result, but this was just ongoing anyway, was the Germanization process. We want to get Jews to emigrate. We want to Germanize their property they leave behind, buy it from them, fair price, boom, done. Okay, it accelerated after Kristallnacht. Why? Because the Jews had orchestrated this and Hitler was through with it and said, all right, that's it. I'm expediting this whole thing. They
sure.
obviously want them out of here. So what happened is there were some cases of extortion where certain NSDAP members took advantage of it and gouged the Jews who were selling their property for this Germanization acceleration. Frick tells everyone at that Air Ministry meeting, those cases are going to be investigated fully, and the people, the Germans that took advantage of the Jews, are going to be not only fined and pay that back, but potentially incarcerated for a while. So it wasn't, you know, they weren't playing around with that nonsense.
Right.
They took action against those guys. And the other thing is the Gestapo ended up taking some actions against SA men and protecting the Jews. So why was the Gestapo defying Mueller and Heydrich's order to stay out of it? You're not to do anything. Just stay out of it. Let them have free reign kind of a thing. And I mean, they both say the police need to be doing it. They don't really specifically mention the Gestapo.
What?
There's just so much nonsense there. And yet the Gestapo is there, you know, protecting Jews from harassment and these rioters. Now, we can certainly start on Ingrid Veckert's presentation. There's quite a bit there. What she says is that there were many, many unknown provocateurs. And the biggest problem is we don't know who made the key phone calls from Munich headquarters, from higher up, you know, these kind of vague identifications that were presented over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who gave those orders to these various SA sectors to start doing these actions. Some of the SA men, having that automatic response to authority, went ahead and did it. they went, yeah, that's a weird order, but yeah, an order is an order. And that's kind of your subordination to authority click were response.
Right.
Others went, excuse me, who are you again? And, you know, the person on the other line would be like, Munich headquarters, that should be good enough for you, and then slam the phone. And then those guys would sometimes go, that must be a joke. And they went back to bed and didn't take any actions. So, again, this all negates the idea that this was top down. There's no way if it was top down, SA men would have been insubordinate like that.
Right. Now, some unknown people were making phone calls.
Sure. Yep.
To whom? To out in the countryside or?
Yes. To various SA brigades, mostly out in the countryside, it seems, almost
in exclusively. The countryside that only the Jews knew that there were groupings of Jews in those areas.
It would seem to me, because these are towns that not even very well-read German historians know about. Just very, you know, out there kind of little hole-in-the-wall towns. Yeah. And one wouldn't think that a lot of Jews would even be out in the countryside like that. They would tend to think they were concentrated in the city. So, yes, this was information that people like Chaim Weizmann et al. Were privy to, because of their extensive contacts with the German Jewish community.
Right. And they're very, very, very unified. I mean, that is one thing that you can say about the Jews, or the Juzis, mm-hmm. as you would call them.
Yes.
Is that they are very unified. They stick together more than any other group of people that I'm aware of.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, absolutely. I mean, they would have been the ones privy to this kind of information. Germans would not have known. Some hole-in-the-wall town they'd never even heard of had so, you know, such and such many Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally think, based on the conglomeration of how these, you know, various points fall on a map, the concentration, if you will, in the countryside is indicative of external planning.
Sure. The other thing,
non-Germans, by non-Germans.
Interrupt.
No, go ahead.
The front page of the New York Times of November 11th, 1938. Front page. Nazis mm-hmm. smash, loot, and burn Jewish shops and temples until Goebbels calls a halt.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty quick reporting, don't you think?
Yeah.
On the front page.
And exactly. Yep.
Hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, if the NSDAP was so totalitarian and so tightly controlled the press, as we're always, always endlessly told, then how did they let that get out so fast?
Yes.
How did they let the Gleiwitz false flag get out so fast? Britain
yes.
had a story immediately. Now, I actually suspect that the Gleiwitz thing was just a big radio hoax. That's certainly possible that was basically invented by Britain, because
sure.
even the Germans, when they investigated it, went, what are they talking about? What happened there?
Right.
They didn't even know what happened. And they had it investigated. And of course, the guy that investigated it turned out to be a later traitor, part of the anti-Hitler
right.
conspiracy.
Right.
So, yeah, there's very strange things there. But yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
All kinds of strange things. New York Times. Yep. 1,000 Jews lost their lives. No. It was 36 reported to Goering by Heydrich and 91 total that ended up being recognized as the official death toll.
Right.
So thousands of Jews lost their lives. That was the New York Times.
And that is always the first thing that people, as you said before, first impressions. That's always what they remember. They don't remember the follow-up story that's hidden somewhere in
right.
on page 25 of the paper.
Exactly. And Goebbels knew that. I mean, he'd put, you know, something about, you know, something that was similar for them, where they didn't want it to be prominent. They'd stick it on page 20
sure.
in the Volkischer Beobachter, give it maybe a tiny little paragraph, and then headline news, Vom Rath died, murdered by world Jewry. So yeah, I mean, and of course the NSDAP is castigated for that, but everybody does that. Everybody's press does that.
Right.
Always. So yeah. And that's just it. It's that first impression. Now, you know, we're always told that this whole thing was led by the brown shirts and that they kind of encouraged this mob attack. But what we only know are two things are a fact. Some NS leaders and brown shirts took part. But the thing is if you count the brown shirts and the mobs, it's still only 0.0005% of the entire German population. Mm-hmm. And of course, Hitler ordered an immediate halt to the violence when he heard about it at his apartment. Why would you end your pogrom?
Right.
Just let it run.
Yes.
It's just ridiculous. Did any Eastern European governments or the Russian government at any time just, you know, freak out about a pogrom they'd unleashed?
Right.
I don't think so. You know, they usually just kind of quietly condone it or turn a blind eye. They didn't really intervene. So,
right. Or say, oh, it was beyond our control. Those locals did it all. And no.
Exactly. Exactly. And then people usually say that, of course, Goebbels ordered the violence on Hitler's instructions. Here's some important facts, though. Goebbels lacked the authority to order a secret pogrom. You know, a secret pogrom, first of all. He was the Gauleiter of Berlin. He did not have authority
right.
over the SS, the SA, the Reich. The propaganda ministry did not have that kind of authority. So again, this is somebody who doesn't understand the power structure. And then, of course, the next morning, he ordered the population to refrain immediately from further actions or demonstrations of any kind against the Jews. So it didn't matter what it was. He was outraged and promptly issued a strongly worded official statement. Now, the press seized on that and went, oh, look, damage control. He's doing damage control for himself. No, that isn't what happened. He was actually trying to stop this. And Steinweiss had to concede Goebbels and Hitler were both defied by the mobs because actions continued even after the very highest authority said, stop. That's Hitler. Who defies Hitler?
Exactly.
Who's really in the party? These were unknown provocateurs from the outside. It's just, you cannot get around that. No one would have defied Hitler. I'm sorry.
That's right.
Yeah. So that's just nonsense. Of course, Ingrid asks who instigated the violence and what was their motive. She says, powerful Jewish organizations in Paris, London, and Washington eager to discredit the National Socialist government. Now, all she can get is circumstantial. That's as close as we can get. There are no smoking guns because the LICA and other, you know, Zionist Jewish entities are difficult to indict directly. One could probably say the same thing about 9/11.
Yes.
Difficult to make a direct link until we get more information, but the circumstantial case is so compelling. It's similar with Kristallnacht.
Right.
So, and of course, at one stroke, NS Germany was dealt a fatal blow. The U.S. Promptly recalled the U.S. ambassador as a result, and a literal wave of anti-Germanism swept across the globe, literally.
Right.
Like, the Americans pretty much turned on Germany at that point. They thought, you know, maybe this can still be a decent country. Maybe we can work with them. After that, it was over with the vast majority of Americans.
Exactly. Even the Germans in America who had supported the NSDAP all of a sudden put away their uniforms because there were people here in America that had mm-hmm. uniforms and they marched and they were very supportive. And then
yep.
all of a sudden, after that, they quit.
Yep, absolutely. And Steinweiss talks about that and then just can't think deeply enough to go, why would they do that to themselves? Just an interesting little fact, the Berlin Wall came down on November 9th, 1989.
Hmm.
Strange,
That's
isn't it?
interesting.
That's when the crystal night started. Is it somehow significant? I don't know. It
Well,
could
that,
be.
yes, that was supposed to have been very significant too earlier, for the revolution in, I believe, Bavaria.
Yep. Yeah,
that was
there you
supposed to
go. There's
start.
another thing. What is November 9th? It was the whole November 9th, 10th was very important to the NSDAP because that was their, you know, the celebration of the putsch attempt.
Right.
So, you know, why would the NSDAP do a harmful action to itself on such a special day when they were all gathered together to celebrate this and didn't even mention any pogrom in any speech?
Right.
This date is important to Red Revolutionaries, not, you know, as something
yes.
that would be attached to a pogrom.
Yes.
This would be the day that more than likely the Jews would choose, not the NSDAP.
Exactly.
Yeah. And especially when everyone's concentrated in Munich. If you're going to have a nationwide pogrom, you don't have everyone in Munich in one spot. How are you going to get the orders out efficiently?
Right.
And the police to go for the fraudulent orders and the fake telexes.
Or maybe they had everybody in Munich so that they could concentrate on those out-of-the-way little places.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's strange things there. I mean, the Jews could think, hey, they're all going to be in Munich, the entire NSDAP, perfect time to strike in the countryside.
Yes.
Police,
etc.
Exactly. It doesn't make sense for the NSDAP to have done that, but for an outsider, it makes 100% sense.
Exactly.
Yes. So, yes, dates are very significant. And then, of course, Wilfried von Oven, a Wehrmacht Army Reserve officer assigned by the High Command Press Section to serve with Goebbels, said that there was virtually no documentation proving Goebbels' guilt or involvement in the anti-Jewish actions. There is nothing. No one can find anything, which is why all of a sudden they had to come up with this Goebbels diary.
Yeah, right.
The missing sections that just so happened to cover Kristallnacht. Imagine
right.
that.
And I'm sure that he was stopping to jot things down in his diary as these things were going on, right?
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. So what else can I hit on before our time is up? How about this one? There is just one document on which all contentions of Goebbels' responsibility for Kristallnacht are based. It contains the statements of a subaltern SS officer on Himmler's staff. His name is Luitpold Schallermeier, to whom Himmler allegedly dictated a memo for file. That memo for file has been doctored. And Weckert points out exactly where that was doctored, just like Goebbels' diaries. Himmler's adjutant, SS group leader General Wolf, told Wilfried von Oven that it was actually he who had dictated the memo to Schallermeier, not Himmler. So now we already have a contradiction. In this memo, Himmler surmised, quote unquote, okay, so Himmler's kind of just assuming that Goebbels, quote, because of hunger for power and his empty-headedness, end quote, had unleashed action against the Jews. So, was Himmler likely, you know, Himmler may have said something disparaging about Goebbels. That's possible because the two were rivals.
Right.
But empty-headed, certainly not. That's one thing Goebbels wasn't. And of course, this is pure conjecture. It is merely what Himmler may have thought. But of course, Himmler's statement denouncing Goebbels as empty-headed is his own self-refutation because no one doubted Goebbels' intelligence. He had always kept his feelings private and had carefully weighed his every statement and action carefully. This is why Oven didn't believe Goebbels was responsible. One other thing about this Himmler thing. He calls Goebbels empty-headed. Oh, yeah, this is his fault. What a buffoon, right? So we're supposed to assume. Yet, he took orders from Goebbels to enact the pogrom, according to the official story of Crystal.
It's very inconsistent.
Any sense?
Very inconsistent.
So, oh yeah, they're just riddled with inconsistencies. One other thing that's very interesting. Wilfred von Oven didn't even recall news of Kristallnacht. He and other Condor Legion volunteers were dealing Spanish communists their final blows when it happened, and he and his comrades had seen hundreds of houses of worship destroyed, as well as the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, many in horrible ways. So, do we hear anything about the Spanish Civil War? Not headline news, Kristallnacht. And the thing is he didn't even hear anything about it. And when you've still got the Spanish Civil War going on, you're going to have a pogrom at the same time and do damage to your reputation when you're over helping this other country that isn't anti-Semitic. You know, Franco didn't persecute the Jews really at all. So that doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah, you really do have to see what else is going on in other parts of the world and what's going on, of course, in America and in Britain to kind of see what could be behind this. What is the motive behind this and what were the objectives and who would it benefit? And of course, we know that Britain was trying to get Germany into a war. So, of course, they have to have some motivating factors. They have to start vilifying the enemy. And hey, if the enemy doesn't do anything wrong, how are we going to vilify them? So of course they've got to have something to say. Now see how those Germans are. Look at what they're doing, and have it, you know, on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere.
Right. Yeah. And one real important fact: Friedrich Christian, who was the Prince of Schaumburg-Lippe. He was Goebbels' adjutant until 1934 and was an official brown shirt leader and representative from the old days. He was in Sweden when Kristallnacht happened, lecturing in Stockholm and Uppsala. He'd been working to gain the sympathy of Sweden. So everything he'd achieved and was working on was undermined, and it made him look like an absolute fool.
Right.
So, of course, he had gone and done this willingly. This wasn't something he was forced to do, full of conviction. And yet we're supposed to believe that Goebbels delivered this blow to his own guy.
I don't think so.
It's idiotic. No one can possibly uphold the official Kristallnacht version anymore.
No.
And when they try using the fraudulent documents, just get the Steinweiss book, Kristallnacht 1938. His case unravels. It's embarrassing.
Yes, it is.
He's based this account on fraudulent documents, and it's real obvious.
Right. And so. This was printed by the Harvard University Press.
Oh, yeah. I got an old library copy that's all kind of trashed and for, I think, a penny.
Appropriate.
Yeah. So I wouldn't spend too much money on it, but if you want to see the inconsistencies and what you can do with fraudulent documents, the kind of magic you can perform, it's a great example.
Sure.
I actually went through the telexes one time, the two fraudulent telexes, and pretended that they were legitimate. And then at the end of the article, I said, gotcha. So that the reader was like, wait, what? Built the whole entire case and then said, this is a fraudulent document, but look at how I built the entire case.
Right.
That's a good method.
Yes.
It really impacts people because they go, wow, that's impressive. You can make a fake document look so genuine.
Right.
And even build an entire thesis on it.
As people have.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Very
and I guess that's about it.
Nice.
There's a lot more on Kristallnacht. We'll have to extend it into one more thing, but it's quite important to go over these things.
Oh, absolutely, because so many things are built on this. So many of the stories of the atrocities are built on Kristallnacht.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
All righty. Well, as always, it's been very enjoyable.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on.
All righty. We'll do this soon.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, take care.
You too.
All righty, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.